Spirit Radio Podcasts.
And joined with me on the line, I have Therese Davey for this week's home and lifestyle tips. We always get the tough one out of the way. What's our job of the week this week, Therese?
Oh, it's going to be the same perennial one for the whole summer. Weed.
I kind of find weeding can be quite rewarding and therapeutic, you know, once you actually get rid of them. But then they always come back again.
Yeah, but just make sure you dump them properly.
How do you handle weed strays that are in, like, for example, really awkward places? They're stuck into, you know, cracks of concrete where they've just managed to get there and you can't get them out with a gardening tool.
There is a great kind of wire scrub brush you can get. I have a fire. There's a burning thing, a device you can set up to burn weeds between cracks. That actually amuses the children on our estate when I get out with that one.
And does that work? Do they come back or does that get rid of them for good?
They always come back. You just
they always find a way.
Yeah, you just have to get over that. Vinegar, believe it or not, I'm getting it in there for the summer. Salt, I've heard people putting on those weeds. There's a couple of options, but the flame-throwing one is an interesting one, and it is used for exactly that reason, between the concrete.
Very good. Yeah, no, I did see it as a special buy in one of the supermarkets recently, but it was all gone by the time I got there. Okay, so what else have you got for us this week? Were you talking about pets and lockdown and how life is affecting them?
There was a 64% increase in pet inquiries from all the pet sanctuaries, seemingly, and they were a great help to many people during lockdown. But now people are going back to work and the pets are going to be left alone perhaps more often. And there was a great article in the FT last weekend on this subject. I just thought I'd share it. How to keep your pets, but also your garden. How to keep your garden safe from the pets, as well as keeping the pets safe in the garden. If your dog is a digging dog, make a dogging pit with some timber boards and bury some treats and toys and let him get used to it. That's his place, that's where it is. There's loads of plants out there that are particularly tough, and the bounce back plants, hardy geraniums and seemingly roses and rosemaries they withstand dogs. So talk to your garden centre if you are planting and you do have big dogs or dogs who like messing about in the garden, to get plants that are right, that will bounce back. This is the odd one that surprised me, cats and lilies.
Okay, go on. What things we have to be careful of with cats and lilies? Illuminate me, please.
Well, bulbs are poisonous, and we all know that, but lilies in particular are toxic to cats, and my favourite, the day lilies, which I put in the garden, to a lesser extent, dogs. But sometimes indoor flowers, like lilies in a vase, where there's kind of pollen and things, or the water, they might sip the water out of the vase. Poinsettia is dangerous to cats in the house if they're wandering around on their own. But the daffodils and the tulips and hyacinths, and you know I'm always telling people, plant some bulbs, but dogs seemingly like them, and because they're round, they think they're balls and they can play with them in the garden. So you need to be careful of that too. Actually, ask your vet the next time for a list of safe plants for the garden if it's a concern for you.
Yeah, and obviously it could easily fall on the cat's fur. Yeah, exactly as you say, and they're licking their fur. And Janie Mack, you've something you would never think about, but thank you for making us aware of that.
Pest control
sprays that are safe for pets, we need to look for.
Yeah, it's a great sentence of this hour of a Monday morning, isn't it? Pet resistant pest control sprays.
Yeah, you're only trying to trip me up on a Monday, Therese. Go on.
That's what I'm trying to do. But there are such a thing as pet resistant pest control sprays out there. And seemingly they're introducing calcium to the plants, and things like pigeons or deer or rabbits even don't like them when you spray them or use them on your plants. So well worth talking to your garden centre if you have a problem with that. They are out there, pest resistant pest controls. Another thing, if you have a terracotta pot and some lovely warm compost and the pot is heating up beautifully, you have a cat, you know by this stage that your cat loves that terracotta pot because it's like a little hotbed for her. So a bit of wire or netting over the top will solve that. We actually used, when we had a cat, we used to use a rack from an old cooker. And we were dumping a cooker and we saved the racks and we put it on top of the pots and the cat couldn't get in. So go visit your local scrapyard and find an old oven or fridge and recycle two of the racks to protect your seeds. Dead handy things to have. And while you're there, Wendy.
Go on.
While you're in the recycle, I'm back to recycling in the garden. Keep a lookout for abandoned drawers in lockers or furniture. So someone's dumping a sideboard or a locker or something. They're great for planting your seeds. Take one of the drawers home and fill it with your compost and put the nasturtiums, because they're the easy ones for the children, or the sunflowers. It's not too late, but they're great fun. But try planting in an abandoned drawer. great idea. Don't have to buy a pot. You're recycling. I got a lovely one at Christmas and put two roses in it for the front door, you know, kind of the miniature roses, and they were great, and it's quirky and it's a bit of fun.
Very good. Therese, as always, thanks for those lifestyle tips. Oh, yes, also you want to just remind us to be thinking of particular people as churches reopen again.
Absolutely. It's time to say, and we haven't had a gratitude spot in a long while, but please don't forget to say thank you to our pastors, our priests, our clergy and their support staff for finding the money and the efforts and the equipment to do the online viewing over our lockdown and keeping us all in touch with our faith communities. Don't forget to thank them when you meet them this week.
Spirit. I know so many of you listening will be so happy that, coinciding with the easing of restrictions, finally churches will reopen their doors to public worship. It'll be the first time churches can reopen since December, and only then, I'm sure they were only open for a few weeks. So it's really been the best part of a year that church doors have been closed to for public worship. And of course, worship resumed in Northern Ireland much earlier on the 26th of March, which I think added to many people's frustration. Online to tell us more, we've Pastor Nick Park, who's the Executive Director of the Evangelical Alliance Ireland and Senior Pastor of Solid Rock Church in Drogheda. Nick, we talked before just as about that kind of frustration about the fact that churches were remaining closed, and I know yourself and many other church leaders and individuals as well have worked hard to try and make sure that the government realise that public worship is an essential service.
Well, yes, indeed, we've been pushing this line all, you know, for a long time now, and it has been frustrating, but we are just so delighted to see churches opening again this week.
So how will it work in your church then, Nick, for people who want to attend services? Do they have to book, or how are you managing it all?
Yeah, we're using Eventbrite, you know, for people to book in advance. Now, although the headline announcements in the media have all mentioned a 50-person capacity, the government has actually got the protocol they had before working, whereby larger church buildings can seat people in zones of 50, where there's sufficient space and where each zone can have a separate entrance-exit. So we're going to be having 100 capacity in our services, for example, in Drogheda. And we can't wait. We're not waiting till Sunday. We've got a worship service tonight. So
you're like, let's get going. We can do it now. And I'm sure so many people are just so delighted that it will be happening again.
That's right. We didn't want to wait a full 6 days for our first service in over 4 months. So we're meeting tonight, thank God.
There's other things, though, that I know, obviously, and you've made it clear there, Nick, just about depending on the size of the church and all that sort of stuff, it might be more than 50, but it might also be less if it's a smaller church as well. But so we're allowed to have services and masses and all that sort of stuff. And weddings and funerals, there's a change there as well.
Yes, the numbers have changed on the weddings and the funerals as well. You know, so there are more numbers allowed at them.
Yeah, I haven't got the exact numbers in front of me right now.
It's
gone from 25 to 50, but then other things aren't allowed to happen depending on what Christian denomination people are. But things like confirmations and communions, they're still kind of put on hold. So it's kind of church back in a light way.
Well, that's true. And I think the main concern over, for example, confirmations and stuff like that is it's actually the congregating afterwards that I think is what's concerning the government there. You know, to do a confirmation is going to be no more dangerous health-wise than having a normal church service. But I think it's the fact that the get-togethers are always seem to go along with such events.
And Nick, what sort of things have you had to put in place, protocols? Have you lots of kind of volunteers and stewards trying to help with church services as they resume?
We have indeed. We've got lots of ushers. We've got sanitising machines, you know. We've got, we had to replace all our church chairs to make ones that were easier to wipe down between services and disinfect. And we even have a maitre d' in our church.
Very fancy.
Well, you know, rather than having the pastors running around trying to work out who's sitting where and everything else, we just have one guy who's our supremo in charge of who sits where and bookings and everything else, just to keep things moving along smoothly.
Yeah, well, we are so delighted and praying for a lovely service for you and all at Solid Rock Church tonight, and indeed to everybody who's going to be able to attend a service today. Gosh, I know I can't wait now. Hope I get a place this Sunday. That was Pastor Nick Park, who's also the Executive Director of the Evangelical Alliance Ireland and Senior Pastor of Solid Rock Church. Spirit. What sort of car are you driving around in at the moment? And are you have you been in a situation like I have before where you're thinking, that shouldn't be coming out of my exhaust? How environmentally friendly is this car going? You know, that kind of thing of keep running it until it runs into the ground. Or are you thinking, well, should I get a hybrid car or an electric car? That's if you have deep pockets, because they ain't cheap. What are the environmental impacts and what are the differences between a hybrid car and an electric car compared to what you might be driving at the moment, a petrol or a diesel car? Online to give us her thoughts, we have Susan Adams, environmentalist and educator in conservation and climate change. Okay, Susan, maybe just give us a broad overview about, you know, electric cars versus hybrid cars, and are they as environmentally friendly and ethical as they're advertised to be?
I think they are. Look, I think we're at the beginning of an industrial revolution in terms of the travel industry. So first off, it's really exciting time to kind of be looking and embracing change. And if we break it down to kind of like air pollution and air quality, you know, hybrids and electric cars are much better. But in saying that, the newer petrol and diesel cars have improved on emissions also. But really, you know, we can break it further down again then to how carbon intensive it is to actually make a car in the first place. So, and then, of course, we can bring it all the way back then when we're looking at electric vehicles. So how ethical are the batteries? And there's a lot in that area then around in terms of the materials used in the batteries, like cobalt and lithium. Lithium, for example, is mined in Chile and Argentina, and it's very, very water intensive. And then cobalt is mostly mined in Congo, and there's huge human rights issues around that whole industry there in terms of child labour, and just not very pleasant stories. But excitingly, Nissan and Renault have pledged to have cobalt-free batteries by 2025. So I think we're at the very beginning of a very exciting time in terms of what's coming down the line in our cars. But yeah, for sure, I understand.
It's moving in the right direction, but there is nuances to it. But I suppose, I guess it's a case of if suppliers see demand, but they know the demand is to have it as green as possible and as ethical as possible. What about though, Casey, and I get an electric car, you know I can get my grant for my charging point and all that, but then obviously that electricity is burning sometimes fossil fuels or whatever. So are the dots being joined there?
So, well, we're currently in terms of electricity in the grid, so we're about 30% renewable energy. By 2030, the aim is to be 70% renewable energy. But I think as well, we can be very critical on all these changes that are coming in terms of the environment. Like, we're getting there and our governments have made promises. And, you know, we're like, well, I'm in the same predicament. Should I keep my old car or will I get a new one? What'll I do? And I think that breaks down to, you know, if you do have your 02 Toyota and you don't know what to do, but you want to make a difference, that also depends on how you travel and where you travel. So if you have an old car and you're only going into town once a week to do your shopping or go to the post office, then probably keep your old car. But if you have a 02, whatever it is, and you're driving up and down from Wicklow to Dublin every day, then you're probably better off investing or upgrading to a newer, more environmental car. But I get it, because we're on the cusp of something kind of very new and very exciting. But the choice is also going to be taken out of our hands, because legally by 2030, the combustion engine won't be sold in Ireland anymore. And business is reacting to that. So we're seeing Nissan, we're seeing Toyota, Tesla, all of them are reacting to what's coming down and they're improving car efficiency to reduce emissions. So it's exciting.
Just on the second-hand car thing, as to whether to make that call, Susan, as to whether you'd get a new car or trade in or get a second-hand car, because we've talked about, you know, trying to consume less. I picked up a big bag of second-hand baby clothes at the weekend. I was delighted. Is it the same when it comes to cars? In other words, are you better off getting a newer second-hand car than buying a brand new one from a consumer perspective?
Yeah, well, like you say, I suppose it depends how deep your pockets are. Like, the newer cars are definitely more efficient. And then, you know, the electric cars as well, they don't involve as much maintenance in terms of getting them serviced. They don't need as many parts either as well. So if your pockets are deep enough, go for it. But unfortunately, a lot of us aren't. So I think, again, as I said just in the beginning, even the newer petrol and diesel cars have improved emissions because they have to come into the standards that are coming in around environmentally, just improving air pollution. And diesel cars, for example, are very pollutant in terms of air quality. And Ireland are part of the World Health Organization in terms of keeping our air quality up to standard, should you say. So, I think improvements are coming. It comes kind of down to chemistry then, whether you're going for petrol or going for diesel. Newer cars do use less oil and they require fewer parts and they are less labour intensive as well. So they are a bit better for your pocket, I suppose, if you can fork out that little bit more. But I do believe that grants will come in and they have to come in to help and assist people to get newer cars. So, for example, in Norway, a petrol, a diesel, an electric car, there's only about €1,000 in the difference. So there's no choice there for people. They can opt into getting an electric car. As in here, to get an electric car versus a petrol or a diesel car, you're talking well over €10,000 and the rest to get an electric car. That boxes already so many people off the plane, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it has to be accessible for people. And as you say, with this coming in where there isn't going to be combustible cars over the next number of years, it has to be accessible to all. As always, Susan, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. Spirit. Well, there is no doubt that the pandemic has put pressure on all of our mental health, especially young people's. Our next guest has just launched a book about building our children's emotional well-being in a post-pandemic world. The title of the book is A Mind of Their Own. And with me to tell us more, I have Catherine Hill. Catherine, when you think of the pandemic, does it mean that our children's futures are damaged beyond repair?
Absolutely not, Wendy. But having said that, I think our children's emotional well-being in particular has been dealt a very heavy blow. So the book I've written is for parents and it has loads of practical tips on all kinds of things they can do to build emotional well-being in their children's lives. But I actually started writing it before the pandemic. So before many of us had even heard of Wuhan, before we knew what social distancing meant. And then in the middle of writing it, obviously, COVID-19 hit. And so I put lots in there to help parents navigate through this really tough time of COVID, but coming out of COVID, which is equally challenging for our young people. And but overall message is one of hope.
And that's good for parents to hear, because I think that the problem is, Catherine, is that parents can obviously have pressure on their own mental health, but they're looking at their children sometimes and they can feel helpless and overwhelmed. So what sort of practical advice is touched on in this book to help with that feeling?
Well, at the end of every chapter, I have put action points and also activities that we can do with our children, and it's any age, so little ones or teenagers. So just a couple of examples. There's all the basic parenting stuff in there, but some specific messages that help build well-being. So for example, there's a chapter called What Are You Thinking? And it's all about helping our children move from that place of sadness and insignificance, which so many are feeling because of the pandemic in particular, to be able to think more positively. And it's all grounded in science. So the plasticity of the brain means that through the things we do as parents, we can help our children learn to think more positively. The Bible calls it the renewing of our minds. And so one little exercise I talk about in that is called, it's so simple, but it's called blue to true thinking. And so you might ask your teenager to just remember, what are the blue thoughts that they're thinking, the negative thoughts, the catastrophizing, and then you get them to flip them and to think of the true things, to look at those thoughts and examine them and realize they're not necessarily true. Look at what's true and then stick it on their phone, write it on a notebook, and remember them when those blue thoughts come back. Or an example for little ones, there's an example about getting them to, when they're feeling anxious, just to get a shoebox and to help them decorate it and cut a hole in the top. And then you get them just to write down their worries or draw a picture if they can't yet write and post them in the box. And again, in the way that you want to in your family, just working out that that's a way of dealing with them, putting them away. And some families get them out after a month and realize you know, the things we've been worrying about weren't quite so bad as we had thought they might be. So loads of that sort of thing, but those are some of the practical things that we can do to help our children build that really important quality of resilience.
Do you think that just having this awareness of our emotional awareness for our children, helping them with mental health, things like resilience as well, are we kind of entering into a new era of parenting, Catherine?
I think we are. I've noticed over that, which is partly why I wrote the book, over the last couple of years, that Care for the Family, we've had more and more people contacting us anxious about their children's anxiety. So their own anxiety about the children's anxiety being the thing that kept them up at night. And, you know, many of us will have seen newspaper headlines about this. But the good news is there is so much that we can do. And in the same way that we help our children to grow physically, so we, you know, make sure they eat their broccoli, we limit screen time, we teach them how to swim, to cross the road on the green man or whatever it is, there's equal things that we can do to build their emotional health. And really, yeah, that's what's in the book. And I'm really keen that parents aren't feeling anxious and afraid, but know that they can have hope and confidence. There's a great quote from a clinical psychologist who talks about the generation of children who grew up in the Second World War. And he says, you know, we don't call them the lost generation or the damaged generation, but the resourceful and resilient generation. And if we can learn to build that quality of resilience, I really believe our children are eventually, it's really, really tough for them at the moment, but they will come out stronger.
It's lovely to hear that message of hope, Catherine. Thanks for joining us on the programme today. That's Catherine Hill, the UK Director of Care for the Family. And her new book is out now. It's called A Mind of Their Own, Building Your Child's Emotional Wellbeing in a Post-Pandemic World. And you can get it at muddypearl.com. Spirit. What does forgiveness look like to you? Has there been a time in your life that you've had to forgive someone? Or maybe you've had to forgive yourself? Or maybe there's been a situation where you've just found difficult to really try and reach for that forgiveness? It can't be easy sometimes. Well, our next guest is going to share with us what forgiveness has looked like in her own life and how it has helped her faith to flourish. On the line to tell us more, we have life coach Virginia Towo of Triumph Life Coaching. Virginia, maybe just give us a little bit of an overview of your own story in terms of forgiveness and how it changed your life.
Oh, thanks, Wendy. Thanks for having me. Such a privilege and such an honour. Because of time, I'm just going to jump right in and share a little bit of my own journey with forgiveness. Years ago, I experienced a very hurtful situation where my then-husband walked out on me for another woman and left me pregnant with our second child. I was 7 months pregnant at this point, and we had a three-year-old daughter. And for years, I was hurt, I was angry, I was bitter, I was at a loss, I was lonely, I had no one to turn to, and I certainly felt like he deserved whatever was coming to him for what he had done to me and what he had done to our children.
Because you were at home with your children, with these two young children, which can't have been easy by yourself, and he was living a new life with another woman. How, it's understandable, and I think as you explained, Virginia, that you could really let that darkness fester in your mind, in your heart, in your soul?
It was a really, really dark place. You know, as a Christian, because I was a Christian at that time, I really got into a place where my faith was affected. My relationships around me were affected. I didn't trust people. I didn't trust my own emotions. I was just locked into this place where every consuming emotion was about the hurt that this person had inflicted on me. And I didn't see a way out.
So what changed?
12 years of a journey and God intervening. So forgiving him took me over 12 years. And the amount of damage to myself and to my children that we experienced at that time only came through God's grace. See, forgiveness for me was about not forgetting what he had done. It was about letting go of the hurt and remembering without the pain of being left and being abandoned and rejected and all the feelings of bitterness. And if I could talk a little bit about, you know, what forgiveness is not and what I believe through that experience, what I walked through to get to my full forgiveness. So I realized that forgiveness was not forgetting what happened and it doesn't erase the memories. I also realized that forgiveness was not letting go of the other person who had hurt me or letting them off the hook. It is also not condoning or minimizing what happened or saying it doesn't matter. You step into the pain and you acknowledge it. It is not excusing or justifying or covering up what somebody else did. You have to own up to the emotions and step into them and really feel what happened. It is also not saying that you trust the person again. You probably have to set new boundaries and that there may need to be some work done there. It is also not denying what was done to you or that your feelings were hurt or the pain and the anger. All those negative, harmful emotions that are welling up in your soul and the replays in your mind of what happened. Now, the flip side of that, just going through what forgiveness is not. What is forgiveness for people who are online today and just want to start that journey of forgiveness? Well, for me, forgiveness was a choice. It was a decision, and it was hard work. It was an act of my will to say, I want to begin the forgiveness process. It was knowing that this person did something, and I am choosing by the act of my will to forgive them. It meant that I was granting this person mercy that they did not deserve, and it was a path to freedom, for me from this bondage, this place where I was locked for 12 years of my life. I could not see a way out. I could not move beyond the rejection. I could not move beyond the disappointment. I was locked. It's like somebody took the keys and threw them away, and I had a bowl of poison inside of my soul, killing me slowly.
And so the forgiveness was something that gave you freedom. And as you say, Virginia, it wasn't about forgetting what had happened, but actively saying, I want to will the good of this other person while setting those boundaries as well. For people listening who maybe can, for whatever reason, whatever situation they're in, they can identify what you're saying in terms of that poison that it can have, that impact that it can have. And they're saying, how do I get to the place that Virginia got to where I actually want to forgive the person? Because I don't feel like that. What advice would you have?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. Because the ultimate goal here is actually realizing that that poison, that anger and bitterness, that resentment that you're holding against that person because you feel they deserve it and they did this to you, is actually killing you. So to forgive and to move through the process, I'm going to talk you guys through just the points of what you need to do practically. How do you walk out your freedom from being rejected, being hurt by somebody, and how do you practically forgive? Well, the first place is to tell God. Share with God what happened in your life. And you may also need to share with a trusted friend or a counselor or whatever your situation might be, depending on the depth of your hurt or your wounds or whatever the incident was. Then you recognize the pain. Recognize how the hurt you have carried has affected your life and express that to the Lord. Bring it to the Lord. Empty your emotions to Him. And then the next stage is really the important part for me. This was the hardest. Choosing to forgive. Choose forgiveness. Make a choice to forgive the offense and release that person from condemning judgments or whatever it is you're holding them against or yourself. And indeed, even God, some of us even go that far. And the fourth point is to release the offender. This is actually hard. You take those keys and you open the door. You let that person out of that freedom. What I found in my own story is that this person, when I forgave them, they could not forgive them. They were locked in prison. They were walking in bondage. So two lives were actually released and started walking in freedom. That doesn't mean you have to restore the relationship. Sometimes where abuse is a case, you choose to set the boundaries, you release, you forgive, and you move on. So the last point is you deal with the relationship, which is what I said already. You either renew or you release the relationship. You release the person to the Lord, and you stand firm in your decision. You have chosen to forgive, and when your mind remembers, and it will, it will go back to what happened to you, why it happened. This person deserves, you know, to be punished. You know, we don't choose to take the place of the Lord. Just as we are forgiven, we choose to forgive. And then we guard our hearts. We take care of our hearts by continuing to release any emotions that surface to the Lord while refusing to rehearse what happened.
And Virginia, yeah, I know that you're going to be running an online course called The Breakthrough Method. Just briefly tell us, what do you hope that women in particular will learn from this course?
I am running this retreat per se, like a, you know, a beauty retreat for women, but it's a spiritual retreat where I'm going to be, actually forgiveness is one of the modules I'm going to talk about on day four of the retreat. It's just an hour where we come together as women of faith, and I'm going to be talking about clarifying and transforming your God-given story. It could be a story of success. It could be a story where there's pain involved. But it's your journey with the Lord to create a success plan and launch into action to rewrite your story of freedom with the Lord. And this is going to be running from the 24th of May to the 30th of May. It's just 1 hour a day from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m.
Very good, Virginia. And thank you so much for just sharing with us your story and some just really good advice on learning how to forgive. That is life coach Virginia Towo of Triumph Life Coaching. And Virginia, as she mentioned, is running an upcoming free online course called The Life Breakthrough Method. And it really helps to help women just clarify and transform their story and to create a success plan. If you want to find out more, you can go to her website, which is triumphlifecoaching.com.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.